God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. At this time, I'll call on Frank B. to read his portion of Chapter 5.
My name is Frank, and I am an alcoholic, a very grateful alcoholic. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has truly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with a complete abandonment. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. First, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Second, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Third, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Fifth, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Sixth, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry them out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the results of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Standing up here and looking at so many people, my eyes reach all of you, but there's a group sitting in front of me that in 1958, they sowed the seed. And for them, I thank God so much. My drinking got a little rough after that, because I think one time I had 6 months, and it seemed like I had it made, and I got drunk the next week. But these people stayed with me. When I moved to Topeka, the patience that people in this town had for me made me realize that we in AA have got one thing to do, and that is to carry the message. Because when you can carry the message to a hard-headed, German-born, Baden Dutchman, my dad was German-born, I was born in this country. When you can do that, you can certainly do things with a lot of people. But keep trying, and I'll tell you that this guy is going to try until I am 100 years of age, and then I'm going to go up to heaven where we'll have the same thing as we got here. Thank you.
I don't know if anyone noticed my mistake, but I made one. Forgot to introduce myself. My name is Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Ron. To qualify myself. And I'd like to just a couple things here quick before we move on to the guest speaker. When we first came up with the flyers advertising the thing, we all decided that we needed to say something that would let people know that this was an entire Topeka thing, that all the groups were involved. We got, I think, 50 or 60 flyers that George B. had in his basement, and we went through them all, grabbing a little here and a little there. Nothing on our flyer is original. It's all stolen. But we finally came up with the let's join together with the praying hands in the middle thing because we thought it really signified something, and I think that's very much in evidence here today. Because we've had a good turnout from all the groups, and all of them have been working and involved, and this is the thing that really makes us happy. I also want to just briefly mention at the last count that was given me, there was around 600 people here, and that was about 130. There's probably some more since. We're real happy about that. And we're also happy that we have 5 states represented here today other than Kansas, and those states are Missouri, Iowa, Colorado, California, and I guess 4 other than Kansas. They've got Kansas in there too, and 1 foreign country. There's someone here from London, England. I'd like to recognize the cities that we have. We won't ask you to stand and be recognized, but I just want to go over the cities and name them off. Manhattan, Topeka, Kansas City, Missouri, Perry, Hiawatha, Denver, Colorado, Shawnee, Olathe, Mission, Grandview, Missouri, Eudora, Salina, Wichita, St. Joseph, Missouri, London, England, Hoyt, McPherson, Manhattan, Independence, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, Lawrence, Beverly, Pratt, Silver Lake, Graytown, Emporia, Overland Park, Butler, Missouri, Wathena, Sylvan Grove, Creston, Iowa, Mound City, Bigelow, Missouri, Norton, Seneca, Gardner, Junction City, Prairie Village, Hiawatha, Savannah, Missouri, Gardner, Liberty, Missouri, Wamego, Cedar Falls, Iowa, Sparks, Pomona, Fairway, Urich, Missouri, Leavenworth, Forest City, Missouri, Sabetha, Clinton, Missouri, St. Mary's, Hutchison, Rose Center, which is a new one on me, in Baldwin. We may have missed someone. If we did, we're sorry. I hope also that we didn't miss a committee somewhere along the line. If we did, it was certainly unintentional. We appreciate everything that you've all done, and we're already looking forward to next year. And this is the moment you've all been waiting for. And I can't tell you how it makes me feel to be able to be up here. That we won't even try. At this time, I'd like to call on Chuck.
Thank you. I am Elsa's husband. And I'm an alcoholic. I don't believe it. If we'd had a sunshiny day, I guess you'd all gone fishing. One thing that I want to get off my mind. Many of you people have tried to make company out of us. And we certainly appreciate it, really. But that isn't it. That isn't it. You see, the only value I have to you is what you see right now. I am the sermon. Whereas I was a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk, today I'm sober. I can pass the saliva test, and I have proof of it from about half the women in the room here. I'll get the other half after the meeting. Whereas I was one of the most miserable amongst men, today I'm reasonably at peace with myself and with you and with my very own God. And that's the message. You see, if there was anything special about me, I wouldn't be worth a damn to you. Not a thing. This is the wonder of our society. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. Caring and sharing is the thing that makes this program of ours work. When nothing else to date has. No one amongst us has gotten sober by principles or by profundities. We are allowed to get sober by the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we maintain our sobriety by the practice of principles. Now it's with great restraint on my part that I don't preach to you this afternoon. You get a house full of people like this and you want to go profound right now. Lord, what a beautiful thing. And I preach it to follow the hat, you know, any time. And it's a great temptation. But we don't get sober that way. You know, I was talking at Bob White Group in Los Angeles a number of years back. And there was a chap sitting on my left, maybe 6 or 8 rows back. And he was trying to light a cigarette. And he couldn't make it. He couldn't make him pass at the right time. And without saying a word, before or after, a little old lady sitting alongside reached over and got a cigarette, lighted it and stuck it back in his mouth, really. And that's all there was to it. I was there a little over a year later, and he was getting his first birthday cake. We give cakes out our way for birthdays. And he got up there and very rudely said that he'd never heard a word I said. Now, isn't that awful? The thing that had brought him back was the little old lady that lighted the cigarette for him. Now, this is our thing. This is what does it. I've told this story in this part of the country, but not right here. But I love it. Many years ago, a few of us got together and started a Lions Club in the city of Beverly Hills. We lived out there for about 30 years, and this was probably about 30 years ago, maybe more than that. No, it's been 15 years since I left. Pretty nearly 40 years ago. And there was a chap amongst us who was an automobile painter. And we used to have a cocktail or two before lunch, you know. Our meeting was at lunch. And this old boy's name is Jack. And I used to look at Jack and see how well he drank. And I would say to myself, I sure wish I could drink like old Jack. And I learned later that he used to look at me and see how I drank. And he'd say to himself, I sure wish I could drink like old Chuck. Because, you see, we never drank together at night. It was always at noon. Well, when I finally ran out of any place to go and had to come here, Zach had beat me by a year. He was already here. Incidentally, he's still here. He'll get his 28th birthday cake in January when I get my 27th. And so, Zach got sober. Again, because he had to. He had already drunk up all his pink bitter. And he was out of business. So he came wandering in. And after he got sober, he became the best dresser in Beverly Hills. Now there are a lot of good dressers out there. But Jack had the best wardrobe you ever saw. It didn't help him that much because he wasn't as pretty as I am. But he sure had the clothes. And not too long after I got here, Jack got a 12-step call. So he dialed all up. He really got dressed up for the occasion and went down to see this guy. And he was in an old flea bag hotel, and he'd been there for 6 weeks. The place was full of empties. Smelled the same as they all do. That sticky, sweet smell, you know. The old boy was laying on a cot over by the wall. Jack walked in all his finery and started talking to this guy. And he listened a little bit, and then he came up on his elbow, and he listened, Jack. And he said, "Why don't you go home?" He said, "You ain't impressing me a bit." And he says, "Besides, I don't think you ever had a drink in your life." And Jack says, "Well, maybe I didn't. But I came a long ways, and I'm not ready to go yet." And seeing a picture on the wall above this cot of a donkey with a load of wood on his back and a Mexican leading him off down the road, Jack says to the guy, "By the way, how long has it been since that mule winked at you?" And the old boy pretty near fell out of bed. And he says, "What do you know about that mule winking at me?" Jack says, "Hell, if it had been me, he'd been in bed with me for 3 days. The old boy says, "Sit down." Sit down. That's the thing that makes this thing work. Identity. Identity. Some little something that opens the door and allows us to get sober in the first place. We maintain sobriety with the practice of principles. We get sober by the Spirit. And in my book, the Spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing in the world but the Spirit of Almighty God. Because it's spelled L-O-V-E, love. Without this, no recoveries at all. None. We must never lose this sharing, this love of one alcoholic for another. Because that sets us apart. It's a good thing we love each other. Because alcoholics are not very easy to love. As the old saying goes, it takes one to know one. And it pretty nearly takes one to love one. I've had a fabulous 27 years. Almost. It'll be 27 years in January if I don't drink or take a pill. And that's the reason I'm here. I'm so grateful I can't see. Because I can't even take credit for living long enough to come here. Let alone for coming. Because as long as I had the power of choice, my choice was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never came as long as I had the power of choice. I had to run out of everything, including the power of choice, before I could come, even to investigate you. So there's no way that I can take credit for anything, any part of it. And I think that's one of the reasons I've been so slap happy for all this time. The most fortunate thing that has ever happened to me in my entire lifetime was on my last trip out, the bottle beat me to death. It beat me into total and absolute nothingness. And it's the most fortunate thing that ever happened to me. Because had I had to surrender consciously the first time, I would have died drunk. Surrender was not in my vocabulary. I could not do it. It was bred out of me for generations. We were conditioned to believe that surrender was for the weak. The strong man wins his battle, the weak man surrenders. And there was no chance of me surrendering consciously the first time. So I'm very, very fortunate in that the bottle surrendered me. It beat me to death. And then I could come here. One of the things that makes this disease of ours so very, very difficult for the non-alcoholic world to understand is that our performance cannot be explained. There's only one word in the English language that can possibly explain our performance as practicing alcoholics. And that word is insanity. That's the only thing that even gets close to it. We might be pretty sane in every other avenue of life, but where alcohol is concerned, we are insane. Now that isn't just insane whilst drinking. That is insane, period. You know, I was one who thought that I might be a little bit nuts when I was drunk. But when I was sober, I was a pretty smooth operator. Now, of course, with a little time behind me, I can look back and think, if you were such a smooth operator, why did you keep getting drunk all the time? Because, you see, I analyzed myself 10 years before coming to this program. And I saw that I wasn't drinking according to code. I'd had a code for drinking as well as for everything else. My first 15 years, I had pretty well performed according to code. And all of a sudden, I'm not. So I analyzed me and decided it was a personal weakness, something I had to overcome to get rid of, and I set about to overcome it. I became periodic at that time, because you see, I was going to win this deal, and you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. You got to get well to get back in the ring for the next round. And so, for 10 years, I worked on my problem. And the harder I worked, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I worked. The last 5 years, I'm sure, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. It became the obsession of my life. I had to beat this deal. And I was saying to myself, 5 years after everybody quit listening to me, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do. And it came that close to being the last thing I ever did. Now, one of the things that's so difficult for the non-alcoholic mind, you see, I was physically sober between every two drunks for 10 years, as I am right now. I never had one good drunk in the last 10 years. Not one! And between every two drunks, I could look at the record with physically sober eyes. And then get drunk again. You know, there's no way to explain that. There's no way. Long towards the last, I had a pretty good record to look at. And I'm going to quickly give it to you because I'm not going to spend too much time on my drinking. I could look at something like this. First you get drunk, you know. And then you get a little drunker. And then you stay drunk longer. And maybe the first bad thing that starts happening is you begin getting a little static around home. You heard where I got it this morning. And so it sort of disrupts your household a little bit. But not too bad. Now, a little bit later, the police get into the picture. The gendarmes start capturing you and detaining you against your will. Now, this is another thing that's very difficult to explain. Because I never did get to the place where I was comfortable in jail. I just plumb don't like it in jail. But I think my family thought I loved it. I spent so much time down there. Then you start losing a little time. This life has scared me to death because I'd never had a blackout. And I thought people were maybe a little weak that had blackouts. Not a smart guy like me. Until I came to and didn't know what I'd been doing or where I'd been. And it scared me, really it did. First blackout scared the hell out of me. But it didn't scare me bad enough to quit drinking. Because I lived to drink for nothing in the world but oblivion. That's what I was hunting for, oblivion. A little bit later, I had a little trouble with music without any visible means of support. And most of you know this tale, but I got to tell it again. The first time I heard the music might have been about 7 years before I got here. And I was coming off and pretty bad drunk, and I went to the kitchen for a glass of buttermilk. Buttermilk was one of my home remedies. And tea kettle was sitting on the stove. And out with the steam came the most beautiful symphony I ever heard in my life. It was fantastic. And I stepped back and looked at this thing. And I said to myself, this is the greatest phenomenon of modern times. This old tea kettle has suddenly become a receiving set. And I went out and herded the family in to listen to music. They couldn't hear a damn thing. I thought they were nuts. Well, I lived to hear a dozen bands at once. All of them with a different announcer, yakking away. Much of it good music. But you couldn't turn it off. There weren't any knobs. And it came out of funny places. Came out of the lights and the shower and the toilet. That, however, is one of the most pleasant of all the hallucinations, I guess. The next thing was fleas. I've only run into about 5 people in 27 years that had the trouble with fleas that I did. My bedroom would get 14 billion fleas in it. And they'd get all over me, and I'd try to scrape them off, you know, and they'd roll over my hands. And I'd wear myself out trying to get these fleas off of me. And then you just have to lie there and breathe fleas. And that's stifling. That's not good living, that breathing on fleas. Next thing was spiders, about twice as big as this thing, coming down from the ceiling. You couldn't move. And that is not good for the nerves. I presume I'm one of the few people that live in Beverly Hills that was ever charged by a herd of elephants. You almost never see a herd of elephants in Beverly Hills. A little later on, I was meeting the people and talking to them, and they were talking to me. And they weren't around. I think perhaps this was the toughest thing for my family to put up with. Because on many occasions we'd all be sitting in the same living room and I'd have company and they wouldn't have any. man you'd start coming to with cuts and bruises all over you. Tongue about that thick. All full of holes. And you wouldn't know how you got it. They call that an alcoholic convulsion. Now, I've heard many people say you can't have more than 5 or 6 alcoholic convulsions and you die. And I often want to ask them if they mean in one night. But I finally ran out of all my convulsions. The last time I went down, Mrs. C and Dick were sitting in the living room. I'd again gone to the kitchen after a glass of buttermilk. They heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. They came trotting out there thinking they were going to find me in an alcoholic convulsion. But I wasn't convulsing. I wasn't doing anything. I was just lying there as peaceful as anybody ever saw. They tell me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. And they got all exercise and called the oxygen squad to Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. Now, as serious as this thing is, it just tickles the hell out of me. I'm mindful of the many times I came off of drunk, you know, to find that everybody that knew me was looking for me. Everybody that knew me. 95% of them just to tell me they never wanted to see me again. Now, isn't it funny how they ferret you out? Just to tell you they never want to see you again. They can't go about their business and leave you alone. They got to tell you. And I'm sure my wife and kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. They come out in the kitchen and find me dead. They get all exercise and call the oxygen squad. Well, when I finally came to, I remember what happened. There was a young doctor with him, and he told me to all intents and purposes I was dead. That they'd had a hell of a time bringing me back. That, in their opinion, nobody'd ever bring me back again under those circumstances. And he told me very seriously, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. I got the distinct impression that they were against it. Now, this was just 90 days before I came crawling into this fellowship. And I want to tell you what happened. It might have been another 24 or 36 hours when I was able to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking up and down the living room floor. That's the only way I ever knew to sober up. I never heard of an easy way to sober up until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never had to sober up since I got here. I always died until I could live. And I did it mainly walking. And here I am walking. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying and walking. Mrs. C. standing over the fireplace. And I'm walking away from her. And she said to me, Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous? And she might as well have hit me with a ball bat. I turned on her like a lion. I said, you, my very own wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I who have read all the good books with the good authors. And you, what wise, said you wound me deeply. I'd just been dead 48 hours before. And she wounded me deeply. And I said to her, besides, I can write a better book than that myself. Now, there's just 90 days before I came crawling in here. I'd already been drinking 25 years. And she wounded me deeply. Now, this is the reason that the first condition for sobriety is in the first line of the second paragraph of chapter 3. Where it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. Why? Because if we be alcoholic, we are caught in a trap that we cannot spring. We have to have help. And there is no way that we can get help until we recognize the need for help. To accept ourselves exactly as we are, where we are right now, is the first condition for sobriety. Because that'll open the door. We must recognize the need for help. God Himself can't help us until we will allow it. It's a little town called Little Rock, Arkansas, 20 years ago. I was having dinner with our then chairman of the board of trustees of our society. A man whom I loved very, very much, God rest his soul. He died about a year ago, a little more. Bernie Smith. Bernie was a non-alcoholic. And he served our society for 30 years. I always thought he was on the wrong side of the table. I told him so. But he didn't agree. So, he went to hot springs after we got through the conference and dried out. But what a man he was. And we were having dinner. And Bernie said to me, Chuck, if a board of experts had examined you in your 20s and had have told you these things would happen to you if you continued to drink and had have given you the things that eventually did happen to you, would you stop drinking? And I said, why no, Bernie? And his chin fell, really, because he thought he was talking to somebody who was intelligent, I guess. And he says, I mean a board of unquestioned experts. And I says, by whose authority, Bernie? You see, we are not peoples who take to authority very well. If they tell us something, we say, who said so? And they say, well, it's written right here, and they read this verse, you know. And we say, who wrote it? So, what it takes, it takes. And how long it takes, it takes. We must come to see that we need help. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The second condition for sobriety is in chapter 5. Where it says, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Now, any length puts sobriety top man on the totem pole. The first importance in our lives. And I'm one who believes that unless and or until sobriety comes first, we can't have it. And unless it remains first, we cannot keep it. Because otherwise we will not do the things necessary to obtain and maintain it. Now the reason those two conditions come before step one is because step one is a twofold admission of defeat. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol physical, that our lives had become unmanageable mental. A twofold admission of defeat. We have lost the battle twice over. No alcoholic can walk up to step one and take it cold. It's impossible. If any one of you had called me an alcoholic 28 years ago, and I could have gotten up off the floor, I'd have kicked you right in the mouth if I could have seen you. That's something that nobody must know, not even me. And we went to any length to keep it from happening, you know, to keep it a secret even from ourselves. And here we are, faced with step one. Now, if we've recognized the need for help, and if sobriety is number one in our lives, we can go for step one. And this is the reason I am so fortunate again. Because, you see, I got to my first meeting already surrendered. The bottle had done it. Thank God. Everything in chapter 5 was something I wanted to do the first time I ever heard it. Everything in chapter 5. And I'm sure it was because of the state of total abandonment of self in which I got here. And I want to tell you this, and then we'll hurry along. My next to the last drunk started on Friday before Christmas, 1945. My boss had called me in that day, and he said, "Charlie, you've had a lot of trouble this year." He didn't mention alcohol, but he knew that I knew what he meant when he said trouble. And he says, "I think I know the reason. You see, he was a non-alcoholic. I think I know the reason. I think it's because of the pressure you're under. And I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you." No, he didn't. They thought he'd can me, but he didn't. "I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you. And instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. And he said to me, maybe next year you won't have so much pressure and you won't have so much trouble." Now, if any of you in the audience have done any drinking, you know that the only thing that's worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune is good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. Now, this was a Friday before Christmas. And I came to sometime after the middle of January, 1946. I had had something like 4 straight weeks of total blackout. In my last 10 years, I finished every drunk I ever started in bed, drinking the clock around. And this one was a little bit different because I started it really in bed, drinking the clock around. I missed Christmas and New Year's, the time between, and maybe 3 weeks after. But I came through with the clearest head I have ever had in my entire lifetime. Now, this too is strange, because I never ate when I drank. My body was full of nothing but alcohol. My skin was full of alcohol. And yes, I came through with the clearest head I've ever known. For the first time in my life, I saw me with nothing between me and me. There I was. And I knew without knowing why that I'd lost the battle of life. I knew why Mrs. C was divorcing me, and I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why our kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why this same boss had sent word to the house that he was going to throw me through the window if I ever stepped foot in the plant again. I accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life is gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. Now I'm going to say that again because this is the thing that changed my life completely. I accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life is gone and should be gone and that I was not entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became very necessary for me to be sober to die. And I knew I was going to die because I'd come that close to it the time before, and this was much worse. So there was no question that I was going to die soon. But I had to be sober to die for one reason and one reason only. I didn't want to die with the record. I didn't want Mrs. C and the kids and the boss to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. I didn't even want sobriety for me. I wanted nothing for me because my life was over. Just that I might rub out what I could. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. And immediately the curtain dropped. And I had no more sanity. I was sickened to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. It was tough. On many times during the withdrawal period in the past, I'd had my mind come and go like turning a light on and off. But this time it went and it didn't come. And I tried to tell myself that it would, and then my inside would tell me, no, this time the cord's broken. You'll always be nuts. And that wasn't a very nice thing to look forward to. But for some reason, I didn't have to drink. And the time came when I started getting better. And now I want to find you people, and I don't know how. I knew that you weren't in the phone book. You couldn't possibly be in the phone book because this is an anonymous program. So I never looked in the phone book. Incidentally, this is the story of my life. I knew so many things that weren't true that I couldn't learn anything. So the only way I knew to find you was to call men and people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got a number and I called a guy. He was a picture man. And we talked a little bit and he says, have you had a drink today? And I said, no. Well, he says, don't take one. He says, I'm working nights. And I can't take you to meeting tonight, but call me tomorrow. Maybe I won't be working. So I called him tomorrow, and we talked a little bit. He said, you had a drink today? And I said, no. He says, don't take one. I'm still working. Call me tomorrow. So I called him again, and he started the same direction. And I says, I know you're still working. And he says, yeah. I said, you don't need to take me to a meeting. Where's the meeting? Where is there a meeting that I can go to? And he told me, and I went. Now, he might have been my sponsor, but he was working nights. So, I went to a meeting by myself, alone. Now, I like to say that, by myself, alone. Because I'm so often by myself now, but I'm never alone. I guess there's no one will ever know aloneness like the alcoholic has run out of everything, including his own flesh and blood. So, I go to this meeting, and I take a look into the door, and there were about 30 of you in there. This was a long time ago. And you didn't look like me, you weren't dressed like me, and you most certainly didn't feel like me. Because there you were, standing in the middle of the room, every one of you talking, and nobody listening. And it was all happy talk, so I knew you weren't drunks. This is the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall in Beverly Hills, and so I concluded with my keen alcoholic mind that you were veterans, and you were there with your wives to have a party. And I was going to have to leave and come back tonight. The drunks were there. And I turned to go. And here's the miracle of AA now. Here's what I was talking about in the beginning. This is it. Some guy standing in there had been watching me. And when I turned to leave, He trotted over to the door and called to me, and he says, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." "Well," he says, "what were you looking for?" And thinking he was a veteran, I said, "Well, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And instantly, everything about that man changed. He lit up like a Christmas tree. Just boom. And it was obvious that he was glad I was there. Now, I was no bargain.